Okay. Can birds save insects? I say yes, but I would put some caveats on that. I would restrict that statement to North America. And at least that's my plan. So we'll see if it happens. Let's face it. When I try to convince Joe Public that insects are neat, as we know they are, and that they're essential to terrestrial ecosystems, I generally fail. Joe's not interested, and I'm sorry, Faith, but I wish I had your faith in Joe Public. So I want to trick Joe into conserving insects. I want him to focus his attention on charismatic vertebrates, and the most charismatic vertebrates for most people are birds. They're charismatic because they're beautiful. They're non-threatening. Birds don't eat us. And also, they're highly parental, and we as humans can relate to that. Anything that's parental must be something like us, and we're concerned about that. So as a consequence, there are 46 million birders in North America. And there are also compelling reasons why these birders ought to be concerned about the things that they like, the birds. These are breeding bird survey data from 1966 to the present, which outline what is happening to our bird populations. These are averages for each year, looking at the birds along the Mississippi Flyway and the Atlantic Flyway, and you can see that the picture is not very pretty. They're declining regularly and in predictable ways. If you look at individual species like the Cerulean warbler, it's declining 4.5% per year of its population. So if you start in 66, there's only 18 or 16% of its population left now compared to what it was in 66. Kentucky warblers lost 1.5% of its population per year, wood thrush 1%, and there are many, many other species that are on the decline like that. Why is this? Why are we losing our birds? It's really no mystery. We're taking away their habitat and we're taking away their food. When Europeans came to this country, they encountered, at least from the east, they encountered 950 million acres of virgin forest. This is what the virgin forest looks like now. And this. And this. This is where we work and this is where we live. There's not much. I think this is a big slide. It won't, there we go. We've taken that intact forest and we fragmented it over and over again. This is what a typical fragment from my neck of the woods looks like. And of course, we know that when we fragment habitats, we're losing niche space. So you may not have immediate loss of species in that fragment, but the populations are far smaller than they were, and small populations are much more vulnerable to extinction than our large populations. So over time, they do tend to disappear. There's lots of good data from habitat islands and real islands these days that can demonstrate this in progress. And I'll just use one example from Barra Colorado Island. It was, of course, an island formed in the middle of the Panama Canal when the canal was created in 1916. So it's been there almost 100 years at this point. It was a mountaintop, and as the waters from the Chagres River rose when it was dammed to form Gatun Lake, they surrounded this mountaintop. And as you can see, it's not isolated from the mainland by very far, a very great distance. It's less than a mile in any one direction. And also, if you look over to the right there, that's an aerial shot of BCI. It's entirely forested. It's virgin forest. The only development on BCI is the Smithsonian Institute Research Station. Nevertheless, it started out with 283 bird species that were breeding successfully on that island, and so far it's lost 65 species, which is 23%. Several others are on the verge of extinction. It simply has shrunk its niche space, and you cannot pack that many species into a smaller area. Here's the key. Barra Colorado Island is 3,700 acres, so it's a pretty good chunk of real estate. And if you compare that to the habitat islands that we're leaving, particularly in the east, so for example, Delaware, the average woodlot size is 49 acres. So that's 75 times smaller than Barra Colorado Island, and Barra Colorado Island is losing its species. So what do you think is happening in the average woodlot size that we have left there? All right, that's what we've done to habitat. There's no mystery there. What have we done to bird food? We can't answer that question until we understand what birds eat. And if I asked Joe Public what birds eat, he would say they eat seeds and they eat berries, and that's why I put out my bird feeder, so that the birds would be happy. Well, there are a lot of birds that eat berries. If you look at what birds eat when they are making more birds, when they're reproducing, this is a list of the bird families in North America that rear their young on arthropods. So that's insects and largely spiders. And the spiders, of course, eat insects. And it's 96% of all the birds in North America are depending on arthropods to rear their young. If you take insects out of any ecosystem, you are reducing forage for birds. It's that simple. No insects, no baby birds. So if you're going to conserve birds, we've got to conserve insects. And this is how I trick Joe Public. We want him to conserve the birds. He likes the birds. He's willing to do that. We don't mention that we're going to make more insects in order to do that. So how do we make more insect? What generates insect biomass? It's native plants that generates more insect biomass. And this, of course, is straight out of plant-insect interaction theory. 40 years old, Ehrlich and Rabin said a long time ago that insects can't eat just any old plant. And that's because, of course, all plants are defended with secondary metabolites. And only insects, in general, insects require a long evolutionary history with a plant lineage in order to develop the enzymes and whatnot in order to physiologically be able to deal with these secondary metabolic compounds. That forces insects down the road of specialization, and if you heard Dan Jansen's talk, you can see that there's a lot more specialists out there than we had thought. Once an insect specializes on a plant lineage and a group of compounds, it is unlikely that it is able to rapidly switch to another group of compounds in another plant lineage. And estimates are, they are repeatedly coming in, that somewhere around 90% of our insect herbivores are fairly specialized. So that's the problem. What we've done, after we have fragmented our habitats, we've come into our human developments and replaced the native plants. We get the bulldozer out, we pull up all the native plants, and then we put in non-native ornamentals. So across much of North America, the first trophic level is comprised of largely non-native ornamentals. If you look at this picture, that's straight out of a horticulture magazine, which is telling me how I should landscape my backyard. And if you know anything about plants, you know that every single one of those species there is non-native. And that's because we have landscaped only with aesthetics in mind in the past. We have not thought about the ecological function that the plants we put in our landscapes have, and we haven't worried about that because we've always let nature do that. Well, there isn't any more nature out there in most places. It's got to happen where we live and we work. And just to demonstrate this, I walked all the way up to the end of my driveway to look at my neighbor's yard. This is my neighbor. His name is Sam, so he is my good neighbor, Sam. And again, you have to know what these plants are to appreciate how Sam has landscaped his yard, but we'll just show you where they come from. So we've got Asia, Pacific Northwest, Europe, Asia, Africa, Asia, Rockies, Asia. And that's not talking about Sam's grass, which comes from Europe. And he's just part of Sam has 10 acres, by the way, and it looks like a golf course after you get away from the house. It's simply a giant lawn, and that contributes to the 45.6 million acres of lawn that we have in the U.S., which is, what is that, 8 times the size of New Jersey. It's a lot of lawn. What happens when we landscape the way my good neighbor Sam has landscaped? That's what I've been doing now in terms of my research, is to go out and actually measure what insects can use alien plants, whether they're alien invasive plants or whether they're ornamental plants. If they evolved elsewhere, what's that doing to our native insect population? And in this one small study, we'll just call it a pilot study, I went out in my backyard and I looked at the woody invasives that are in my backyard. And I looked at the native plants, native woodies that are in my backyard. I got out my pyrethrum and I sprayed them, and I collected the biomass, insect biomass off these plants. This is the caterpillar biomass I got. And it turns out there's 35 times more caterpillar biomass on the native plants than there are on the alien plants. That's 35 times less bird food that I can tell Joe Public about. I was also interested not just in biomass, but in the species diversity, what's happening to the richness of insects that we have out there when we replace natives with particularly ornamental aliens. So I went to my trusty Michael Durr manual of woody landscape. 5 minutes. Plants. Okay. And I what I want to do is quantify species diversity by records of Lepidopteran use of these plants. We use Lepidopterans because we've got the best host records for that taxon, but it's supposed to be a surrogate for all insect biodiversity. And so here's the answer. About 4 species on average use alien plants, and about 71 species on average use woody plants. If you look at all the averages, about 14 times more biodiversity on these native woody landscape plants. This inspired me, though, to look at all the plants that are out there, not just the ones used in ornamentals. And it turns out that we didn't want to do the whole world, so we just did the mid-Atlantic states plant in green there. So there's 1,385 genera in that space, 884 native genera, and 501 alien genera. Those are our sources, lots of sources trying to come up with these host plant lists. Again, we focused on Lepidoptera. We got records for 743 plant genera. 642 genera have no LEP records associated with them at all. So there's a lot of missing data out there. And this is what it looks like. You see the native woodies there on the left and the aliens on the right. The blue bars are the alien insects on the plants, and the red bars are the native insects, but the total is the yellow bar, and again, we have highly significant differences between the total amount of LEPs on all native species versus all alien species. This allowed us to rank the genera of plants that are at least in the mid-Atlantic states in terms of their value in supporting insect biodiversity. And if they're supporting insect biodiversity, I'm going to argue they're supporting a good deal of other biodiversity. This is the top 10. So Quercus was number one. There are 534 species of LEPs recorded on Quercus in the mid-Atlantic states alone, followed by Prunus, followed by Willows, Salix, and so on. This allows us to direct Joe Public when he's planning his backyard or any restoration project that he may have into picking the plants that are most valuable in terms of producing bird food. Remember, Joe's going to listen about bird food. He doesn't care about saving the 500 LEPs that are on oaks. This is the top 10 of the perennial species. And as you can see, there are far fewer species on herbaceous plants. So woody plants are more valuable. I'm going to have to move along here. If I could plant a single species in my yard, I would choose an oak because it's got the highest level of diversity. I've got a student that's just started a study looking at where birds forage, because they're going to where the food is. They have read Optimal Foraging Theory. And as you can see, the top bars there, we've got the natives on the left and the aliens on the right. The top bars are white oak and red oak. So the birds know where the food is. That's good. I want to show you one quick study that we're going to expand. I found a landscaper who has landscaped high-end landscapes. He's pretty expensive, but he uses entirely natives for rich folks. And this allows me to compare the biodiversity that is attracted to properties landscaped entirely in natives versus ones that are landscaped traditionally. That's a traditional landscape. We controlled for plant biomass here so that we're not comparing plants versus no plants. We're comparing native plants versus some native plants and lots of alien plants. And this is to see whether you bring in those alien plants, are you really going to have more insects, and are you going to have more birds? Yes, you have more Lepidopteran species. Every single thing we measured was significantly different. We had more bird richness. We had more bird species of conservation concern. This is the list of birds that we recorded breeding on these properties that are now on the Partners in Flight list of conservation concern for our areas. You'll see that they used to be common birds, but they're not anymore. Yet they were breeding on the properties that had this is the birds of conservation concern. They were breeding in the areas where we had more natives, and it was the biggest difference we got. And this is Lepidoptera abundance. Somehow these got out of order. That's bird abundance. In other words, it worked. If you start putting more native plants back into the landscape where they used to be, You can make a difference for the birds, and Joe Public will respond to that. And in the same time, at the same time, you're saving the insects. So I think you get the message.
That was perfect.
You rushed me. You mean a source for this plant ranking? I'm putting it on my website for starts. I'm actually gonna try to publish this. I've been saying that for a while now. I'm slower these days, but yeah, I want to get it published and it should be up on my website next week so that you can at least go and see this is how it fell out when you're looking at these species host records. Now remember, what really counts is the biomass that's produced on these trees, and we haven't measured that yet in a comparative way. So that would be in the future.
Doug, are you looking at a possible interaction between host plant diversity of the herbivorous insects as well as a potential interactive effect with floral source diversity? Whether those two synergize or whether they're additive relative to the number of species, herbivorous species that are encouraged in America?
Are you asking me whether I'm looking at host plants versus the number of flowers produced?
Looking at, if you've looked at host plant diversity, oaks don't help provide great floral resources for
right.
many
right.
herbivores, okay? But there may be other native plants. So you've got native and alien
right.
host plants. You've
right.
got native and alien floral resources.
Right.
And there.
Yeah. Now we haven't looked at that. There's no doubt that there's lots of alien plants, particularly perennials, that make lots of flower, that make lots of pollen, and they make lots of nectar, and lots of insects go to those. But fewer insects are produced on those, is my argument. We're not increasing insect biomass in general by providing nectar and pollen. Maybe for the bees, but we need that host plant relationship with the leaves and the roots and the everything else to actually generate more insects. Just look at your buddleia that you put in your yard, your butterfly bush. A lot of butterflies come in to eat that. Not a single one can oviposit successfully and make any more butterflies on it. So there we go.
We can do one more question?
One more.
There's one.
I was just curious how you did the Lepidoptera surveys. Were you collecting adults or collecting larvae?
You mean when I went out and sprayed? That was anything that fell out after I sprayed, but they were mostly, almost entirely larvae. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Doug.